the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
Is Mirror Trading International kingpin Johan Steenberg dead or alive? Those who've been following this story will recall he was reported dead in April this year by the Brazilian press. He apparently died of a massive heart attack. Steenberg, you may remember, was the reputed mastermind behind the biggest crypto scam of 2020 when it convinced hundreds of thousands of investors around the world to hand over nearly 30,000 Bitcoin, which is worth a staggering $48 billion at today's prices. MTI did this by promising returns of 10% a month, as well as generous commissions for introducing new investors. That all started to come crashing down when the Financial Sector Conduct Authority issued a warning about MTI and advised people to get their money out. Steenberg escaped to Brazil, where he was arrested a year later for using a false ID, and Mirror Trading International is now in liquidation. There were a lot of people who were not entirely convinced that Steenberg had actually died. And one of those who wanted to find out using good old journalistic methods was Stephen Tim, who previously lived in Brazil and speaks the language. He went off to Brazil a little while ago to investigate further and joins us now to discuss what he found. Hi, Stephen. It's good to have you on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. I'm just interested to find out what got you interested in the story in the first place. Tell us about your time in Brazil, the fact that you speak the language, and there was obviously something there that sparked your interest.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me on your podcast. It actually started, I've written about a fraudster before, a guy called Eran Eyal. I wrote a book about him called At Any Cost. It came out in 2021. And I've been sort of looking around for another book, prodding here and there, writing some stories, hoping they'd get somewhere. Having lived in Brazil, I lived there in 2014 and 2015 in São Paulo while I was studying Portuguese. And well, my plan was actually to live there. And then I came back to South Africa. I hadn't been covering the MTI story, but I was always fascinated by the fact that it was crypto. I saw that he'd taken a flight to São Paulo. So everyone had under the impression that he'd fled there. And then, I thought that's interesting, it sort of sparked something in me. But then, I saw him arrested and I thought, heck, I got the news on my broadband that he'd got arrested, and I actually emailed my broadband and didn't hear anything from them. So I thought, okay, well, that's weird. If you don't want to, and that was during COVID. So I thought, well, maybe it's in any case, what happened was he went straight into prison. So I don't think I would have got much going over there anyway, because that was my idea. I can speak Portuguese, Brazil. Yeah. Maybe pay me some money or we can come to a deal and I can go over there. And then, then I saw he died, in April. And I thought, time's actually running out if I want to actually, because I don't want to sound pompous here, but I thought, I visualized myself there. And I thought, if anyone's going to cover the story, if I'm going to have regrets later that I didn't cover the story, I'm the guy. I've written about fraudsters. I lived in Brazil. I can speak Portuguese. Come on, man. So I thought, the state of the media today, I'm going to have to fund this thing myself. And, I've got a clear idea to write a book about it. I've already got 50,000 words, actually. Most of it's rough. But basically, I went there last month and I organized everything myself. And to go over there, you need you can't just rock up and say, hi, I'm Stephen Tim. They don't know who the hell you are. So I knew that I'd had to get a publication or two on board, MoneyWeb, they were interested in the piece, and Arake, because I knew through your coverage, Kieran. I mean, you and my broadband had basically been leading with the whole story, so it really gave a blow by blow account of the liquidation. But what was going to happen? But no one knew what was his life like in Brazil. What was he doing there? It was a year in São Paulo. What was he doing there? So. I was keen to find out. And just to tell you, like, people don't speak to you after the arrest, generally. So most of what I actually uncovered was actually from the court records themselves. I stumbled upon the court records, you know, I just sort of Googled, and there's this legal platform in Brazil called Jus Brasil, .com.br. And I thought, you know, I got some of the court documents off that, but most of it I couldn't get because they need a subscription for it. And then I remembered, heck, you know, I'm actually my former fiance from Brazil, actually, ironically, she's a lawyer. And she actually said no problem. And she sent me, you know, it's thousands of pages of PDFs, thousands, really. And there were like four or five. I got everything except for the extradition case. So there were like, if I recall now, there's like five matters. So minus the extradition matter, there were four, and it runs into thousands of pages. I used that ready to, you know, from the court documents. I just can't believe people. It must be the state of journalism these days. But inside, because there were blogs in Brazil reporting like on Merit Trading International, on Johann Steinberg. Why did they not uncover these? Why did they not get hold of these court documents? Because inside the court documents, there are names, there are phone numbers, addresses. I mean, I just harvested all of that. And I can tell you, man, I've got Excel spreadsheets. I've got freaking bios that are made of these people. It's complicating. I couldn't understand what was going on. So I had to make timelines, and I literally read over the stuff many times to actually understand what was going on here. And then you also have to build a narrative.
Let's just pick it up at the point of where you're going off to Brazil. You've got the court documents. So you've got thousands of pages of court documents. But where do you start? How did you begin this investigation? Who is your first point of contact?
You know, literally, I had a spreadsheet. And the only person I had, I think it was literally names that I got out of my broadband and MoneyWeb. And I thought, heck, there's only like five or six people. And if I look at the spreadsheets now, it's just you get one name, and then you kind of, you know, you're a journalist. You get other names. You go into the court documents, and you're like, who the heck is this person? You put their name down, and then you start thinking, okay, he's at the cemetery. Okay, so cemetery. I need contact details for the cemetery. You need the person that did the autopsy. The federal police, the military police. I mean, it goes on until you've got the prosecutors. And a lot of the time I was speaking to spokespeople. You know, that's where I kind of started. And I can say that I don't want to generalize here, but Brazilian people are very they're very friendly. So they will send you an email back very quickly and say, thank you very much. And now we are going to come back to you. And often that's goodbye. So you have to keep persisting. And I think it helps if you're actually in the country, because then they can see, okay, this guy's not Mickey Mouse. And I got a letter from MoneyWeb saying I'm working for them. And it was in Portuguese. I translated it in Portuguese. Yeah, there's a lot of work going into this that people maybe don't realize. You know, that if they just read the story, they think, okay, this is interesting that the guy went there. But a lot of the time I was in a hotel room just emailing people and phoning them through Skype onto the landlines and speaking in Portuguese. And the other times I would just go to, I got the addresses of all the places that he was in, all the places that had some relation to him in São Paulo and the city where he was arrested in Goiânia, and I actually literally made a Google map. So on your Google account, you can actually like save like destinations you want to visit in a city, and I did that. It's actually what I did with Iran Eyal before when I went to New York to see the places that he lived, and you get a real feel for like, okay, like you might think, oh, this guy is fantastically rich, you know, he's got all these Bitcoins. But then you go to, you know, by the end of 2021, now he's been arrested. He's been living in São Paulo for a few months. It's literally a couple of months after the liquidation, and he moved in with his second girlfriend, Karini. And you look at the kind of really ordinary place that he moved into, right next to the Congonhas airport, and is a favela literally 200 meters down the road. And this is not, you know, literally 2 or 3 months before that, he was in the 32nd biggest, tallest building in the Mandarin building in Tiambibi, the 32nd tallest building in Sao Paulo. And it's literally got a gate that looks like Louis the 16th. I mean, it's got this big thing like "Don't stuff with us" and this sort of 3 meter high wall with freaking electric fencing all around, and a guy who comes to you with a big duffel jacket when you're standing there and goes, "Yeah, can I help you?" And you say, "Well, I'm a journalist. Here's my business card. I just wanted to..." No, you've got to get an appointment. And you went from there to this place where he's small place. So it shows you there was something going on there. And what I want to say is that this entire thing remains a mystery. A lot of the thing, I don't have all the answers. I can't dig up his body if it's there, because I went to the cemetery, and they told me, you know, it's block E 299, and I get there, I get to where block E 299 is, and it's clearly on a little metal plaque or something on the ground, and I look at the names on the grave, and it's like all these Andrades, and I'm like, this is not him. There are three names there, but his name is not there. And you're left with a lot of mysteries.
Let's just take that point up there now. So you've arrived in Sao Paulo. You've made contact with some of the people that you've been able to harvest from the court documents. Who was the first person you spoke to?
Look, if I can tell you, I had names of these, but no one was responding to my messages. You know, I'd phone them with my Brazilian cell phone number, and they would people wouldn't answer, or you send a WhatsApp and there wouldn't be any answers. You know, I'm trying to think now, because there were so many people that I spoke to, but like, or send messages out to.
So at what point did you have a breakthrough and you got contact with somebody significant?
Like, I don't know if I had any breakthroughs. I got like a tip off maybe from one person, an MTI investor, another journalist somewhere. And I'd have to obviously follow up these tip-offs and stuff. But I did meet his attorney, and I got a very bad vibe from him. For example, he ignored my first two emails. I phoned his office like literally 3 or 4 times from South Africa. When I came there, I had a SIM card. I phoned him, and he answered the Brazilian SIM card number, because now I see his Brazilian number, and he doesn't know it was me, obviously. After that, I said, no, I'm not in Guyana now. I'm in another city, but, you know, send me a message when you're there. Send him a WhatsApp. He doesn't respond. So I had to go to his office, and I kind of ambushed him on the way out. And he looked like, you know, that kind of look that you get where you're like not wanted in that place. Like, what are you doing here? I'd sent him actual distinct questions, you know, concerning the case, because I know that's how you can't just like say a comment. You got to actually have questions, because otherwise you're not going to get anything. So I actually had 3 questions concerning discrepancies I had about the case. This guy did not want to comment about them, although they were very simple questions, really.
Well, in the story that you wrote in MoneyWeb today, apparently the interaction with the lawyer, he said the case is closed. He doesn't want to. It was a very dark thing for him. I can't remember the exact wording, but he really didn't want to discuss it, and it was over and done as far as he was concerned.
Yeah, it caused a big headache for him. I mean, shame. Come on, man. He's a lawyer, and he's got a massive farm. I mean, like, where do you think... I don't know. He's a defense lawyer. Please, you know, this is what he does. So I did say, look, I'm sorry. And then what more must I do? And then I understand it. But there's something funny about that.
Did you manage to meet the girlfriend?
So that's interesting. I actually went to her, like, I had a map. So I went to all the people's places. I went to her place that's right next to her parents. So he lived in his, he lived, he was staying at the, at her parents' place when he was arrested, and not at the parents' house, but at a, just like a kilometer from there outside a massive wholesaler that's a bit like Macro. They were in a car and they got four of them with a girlfriend. The girlfriend stays right next in a house right next to this neighboring the parents. I walked past there. I took photographs. Actually, I was taking photographs of what I thought was the what I had the address of for the parents' house. And I only figured out afterwards that this was actually Karini stayed right next to it in a house right next to it. Maybe she bought that house possibly after or moved in after Steinberg went to prison.
And Karini is the girlfriend.
Yes. I knew where she worked. I walked past where she worked one time, but it was a Sunday. I don't think she was there. I didn't know what I was going to say to her. So, you know, I did not actually interview her. And I also want to have empathy because she's the girlfriend. Like she, I don't know what she claims that she did not know that he was a fraudster, blah, blah, blah. I got hold of some other cases involving Karini, which was basically over a divorce lawyer situation. So I wanted to try and see what is this woman like? Is she, and what I got from that court case involving a divorce lawyer, where she wanted to sue the divorce lawyer for R1 million, which is like 3 million rand over like, basically she didn't give her like, get her enough out of the divorce case with the ex-husband. And she slipped up a couple of places that the lawyer, she claimed. In the end, the lawyer only paid her out 40,000 reais. So what you can see from this case about Karini, and this was only resolved a couple of months ago, was that she's an opportunist, anything. But whether she's a criminal, because, you know, if she's a criminal, she's fair game, I would say. Like, what was I going to ask her? Because she was going to deny anything. Maybe I will come back to her. And also, I didn't want to put myself in a threatening position. Like, I'd have to go into her office. Oh, I mean, a business place. She works as a, she does liposuctions and Botoxes. She's qualified as a dentist. Apparently, dentists can do those things. So, yeah, it was a thing. It was the only person that I hadn't tried to get hold of. I've got all her details, man. I've got her email addresses. I've got a business, like I said, business address. I've got a phone. I've got a few phone numbers. But something in me just told me, like, hang off, yeah, man. And also, I'm not a paparazzi. I also didn't want to get myself killed over there. Not that she's a...
So just talk about the dangers there, because there are gangs involved. Here's a guy who's known probably to have quite a lot of crypto somewhere stashed away. He would be a person of interest. And this is not the first time that we've heard of people being kidnapped, for example, in Brazil, to try and get access to their crypto. So what were the dangers that you came across or were aware of?
Yeah, look, I was a bit wary of that whole thing. I was wary because there's a lot of suspicions that when he arrived in Brazil, one investor that was speaking to me off the record was telling me, you know, he was hanging out with, when he arrived there, he was hanging out with some dubious characters, and there were some names, I got to say, in the court documents that I didn't know who these people were. So I didn't actually bother phoning them because they did look like, if there's anyone sort of dodgy, I mean, you've got the biggest gang in Latin America, the First Command, they are based there in Sao Paulo. And there's a lot of stories that I came across of, you know, guys getting that were running crypto schemes or that had a lot of crypto, even where the police were even like, you know, lifting, like extorting the money out of them and kidnapping them and stuff. So it's very possible. So I, you know, while I was there in Brazil, I didn't take any chances. Like if someone was going to meet me, I was not going to meet them at the nighttime. I didn't go out to bars late at night and get drunk or anything like that, because I was actually really worried for my safety. I do know São Paulo very well, and I sort of know where the good and bad areas are, but I'm still a foreigner, and I could be the perfect target. And I didn't know, who I might encounter. So I was, I wanted to find this story, but I was also limited by this, what sort of dodgy characters would he have been involved in? And that's still a big question.
Okay. Did you manage to meet or come across any of the people who were in his circle or knew him or were in prison with him? Because he wasn't really in prison, was he? He was in a kind of a house arrest situation. Did you manage to track down any of those people who knew him then?
Just to correct you there, he was actually in the special custody unit, which is like a nice part of the prison where they only have like 60 people held. So basically that's like the high risk, what do you call it? Like there's a guy there who stayed with him. Apparently he was isolated totally. The guy is Brazil's biggest serial killer. I kid you not, like 2014 he arrived there. Steinberg arrived end of 2021. So like I tried to, that's one of my things, I wanted to visit the prison, but the prison through their spokespeople and all that, they told me basically the media can't visit you, and the only time the media are ever allowed to come to, because I said, can I check out his cell? I've got the number of his cell where he stayed, from the court documents. They were like, no, the only time the media can come and visit the prison is when we have like some PR stuff about, the prison being following social conditions and health and stuff like that. So they didn't want, so what was I going to do? So I didn't even actually bother to even drive to the prison because it's a massive prison complex south of the city. One can get a good idea of it through maps and Google Earth or whatever. But yes, he was under house arrest when he died. I was told by the prison authorities that he started serving house arrest in about July last year. So here's a guy, he had his laptops, his two laptops and his phone, his iPhone. He was under house arrest. Big suspicion was that house arrest served at the farm of the lawyer, who's a very well-connected individual. What were they doing for 10 months? Sorry, the only time you ever allowed to leave house arrest, the address, is when you've like got a medical condition. And guess what? He had a medical condition. Apparently he died of a pulmonary embolism, which is basically a clot on the lungs. You can get it from smoking can cause it. So I wanted to go visit the farm, but I couldn't get the address. I'm still waiting for them. I got sent from pillar to post. If that's not a sign for you, I don't know what is. First, the prison department told me to speak to the prosecutor. Or I said, can I speak to the prosecutor? Yes. The prosecutor told me, no, you have to go to the federal justice department. So now since like 6th of November, I've been waiting from the federal justice department. And by the way, between the guy telling me to go to the federal justice department and it was like a week where he was just not coming back to me. And I said, give me your phone number or something. I don't know what is going on there. So,
all right. Just to start wrapping this up. What's your feeling? What does your investigation tell you? Did you get it? Were there red flags there that said, I don't know that this guy actually died, that he may have faked his death. He certainly got a lot of Bitcoin. He could have paid a lot of people a large amount of money and bought himself some anonymity. Or did he really die? I mean, he looks like a fairly overweight guy, that he might have been in poor health, a heart attack or a blood clot or a lung clot. Wouldn't be beyond the bounds of possibility. Still, a lot of people aren't convinced that he actually died. What's your take?
At the beginning, I believed that he was likely dead. Now I'm sort of 50-50. I'm like, there's no reason that he shouldn't be dead, but then there's also a whole lot of unanswered questions. It's not very neat. You got the video camera in the room where the wake was held, wasn't pointing at the table where his body would have been lying, but obviously the camera was for security reasons, and that's why it was pointing at the door. So I think with every conspiracy theory that you might come up with, there's a sort of like you can validate and say, no, but the camera there, oh no, but it's a security camera, so like that's why it doesn't point that way. And then you go to the guy's grave, like it does look like there was earth moved in that patch. And why didn't people want to speak to you? So like I didn't get hold of any of his buddies. I sent them emails, his first girlfriend. Like everyone has either disappeared, they've changed their phone numbers, or they just don't want to come back. So it's understandable. People don't want to, they realize that they're only going to have negative things come out on them. And their name has been completely tarnished because it's linked to this guy whose name is tarnished. So that's more than anything, that's why they just don't want to speak out. It's basically like a tour of all these sites where he visited, like, and almost like a history tour that I was on, and trying to think what was actually going on here. So it's very difficult. I don't know if I achieved much. I might have raised more questions than anything, but you got to be very careful about actually saying that he faked his own death, because it's very difficult to fake your death. You need a lot of money, which he maybe did have, and you need to have all these things lined up. So there's a lot of documents that you need to falsify and stuff like that. So it's not very easy.
Well, I think the Thabo Mbeki case in South Africa proves it can be done. How long it can be done for is another question, but there are ways of doing it, and it has been done before around the world. And, you know, here is a case of somebody who had presumably, or under, certainly there was suspicion that he had a lot of Bitcoin, that he could buy a lot of people. And he would certainly have been in prison. My suspicion was that, you know, he would have been a target for the guys who control the gangs who control the prison, and he probably would have had to buy himself some protection inside the prison. And maybe that's how he got out. And then, you know, the plan B from there was to make his next move. What is your plan now? Are you going to follow this up a little bit further? I guess the only way that we would know for sure is if there's an exhumation of the body and you can get some DNA testing. You know, is that really Johann Steinberg that's buried there? It is suspicious that there's no plaque with his name on it, that it's in the, it seems to be an area of the cemetery where the family of the girlfriend, you know, some of the deceased members of her family are buried. That's all. There's a lot of strangeness about this case.
No, look, my plan now is hopefully to find out more. I'm sure, as you know, Kieran, you put out stories and then maybe you get like tip-offs and phone calls from people that they've got all sorts of reasons they want to get hold of you for. I'm hoping that maybe someone in Brazil might tell me something that I haven't known before. It's very difficult because I think the story will mostly be, it'll take a while to get sifted back there because of the language, the difference. I feel like the other big missing part of the story, because I'm sort of working on turning this whole thing into a book, is that people we know about the liquidation, we know now something about the Brazilian side of what he was doing there, but we don't know about the early Johann Steinberg. What was he like? How did he get? He was apparently in some other scams before Merit Trading International, and then second to that is, who are these other people that were all involved? And there's this theory that Johann Steinberg was the fall guy, that he was this clumsy oaf that basically was just burying himself bigger into a hole. And the real people that were, I mean, this is according to Johann Steinberg's defense as well in Brazil, that the real people, you know, are the other executives then in MTI. So I think hopefully the focus doesn't disappear from those people, because if they've been involved in other cons, especially they need to pay for them I mean, justice needs to happen. Like, this guy got off on, like, basically he never really paid for his, he was in jail on a fake ID, and they were holding him, two fake IDs, actually. They were holding him in preventative detention in Brazil, waiting to invest, while they investigated further. Like, there was, he was acting as a broker in São Paulo. What was going on there? And it looked like MTI all over again, really, if you...
Oh, really? He was acting as a broker in São Paulo?
Yes, he was exactly how MTI was working in South Africa, literally. He was taking people's crypto, some Bitcoin, and investing it in the marketplace, and then taking capital from them, like converting into dollars, and then buying crypto, Bitcoins, I think it was, and then giving them back the capital, plus, like, he would say that he would give them 5% a month or something. Was it 5% a week? Something ridiculous. It was like the same story all over again, except now on a bigger market, because Brazil's like the 10th largest crypto market or something, according to Chain Analysis at the moment. So yeah, they say fraudsters like this, they never learn. They will always be fraudsters because they don't think that they're doing wrong.
Was there any indication from the court papers what happened to that particular business that he was running out of Brazil?
It wasn't a business, actually.
Did people lose money?
It seems it's very vague, but it seems that there were some people that lost money, and it does seem that some of the people that lost money might have. I'm just putting this as a speculative theory here because it's not conclusive, but they could have been. This is how he might have been arrested. They might have gone, "Hello, federal police, we've got a guy here, South African, is using a fake ID. And he's wanted by Interpol or whatever, like, please." Because how was he arrested only 5 days after arriving in Goiânia? And they arrested him in a very specific spot. Like, how did they know he was there? How did they know that literally he got into, and this is obviously putting things out there for you guys. He literally got into the car with three other people and they drove. I walked this distance. It's a kilometer. So it's like an 8-minute drive or something, to the macro warehouse type place, and the cops arrested him in an unmarked car, by the way. They arrested him right there. Not arrested, but apprehended him. So how did they know this? Unless someone was working with him, you see what I mean?
And so he had just moved to Guyana, this town. He'd moved from São Paulo, where he was running this broker business, and then he'd moved to Guyana, which was where his girlfriend had a farm. Is that correct?
No, his girlfriend, I don't know if she has a farm, but she had a house there and the family lived there, her family. He told his friend that he wanted to marry Karini, the girlfriend. It's not clear whether they actually got married. There was a ring that was presented.
He already had a wife in South Africa, Narina, that he had abandoned.
Exactly, man. And not only this, Karen, what I also discovered was that I think at one time he was actually going out with both of the girlfriends at the same time. And he had a wife back in South Africa, right? So, look, this to me completely demonstrates a guy that's got no moral compass. I mean, he was also, by the way, he was in sex motels, probably with the first girlfriend, because the address is a motel. And I know these motels. I lived in Brazil, right? So motel, it's not like, oh, let's go to the motel because it's cheaper than a hotel. No, no, you go there to have sex. So he was there a few times at this hotel, at motels. At one time he gave the second girlfriend, the one that became his life partner or whatever, he gave her earrings. But a month after that, he was paying for, there was receipts to prove this, a receipt, he was paying for the renovations to be done for the girlfriend number one's apartment. So you got to wonder what's going on here, man. The guy was screwing over three people at the same time. Yeah. Incredible person, really.
Was there not also talk of cocaine and helicopters? This came out in the arrest warrant.
Yes. Yes. I mean... Okay, so the helicopter thing's interesting, like 3,000 reais, that's, at that time it was 8,000 rand, on a helicopter trip from São Paulo, this is just one way, São Paulo down to the beach at Guarajá, I think, And he used the same helicopter company a few times under his fake name, Clayson, D'Alameda, or I think it was, or something. So, yeah. And then...
the cocaine. Was there not also cocaine involved?
Oh, yeah. So, yes, yes. Look, he must have had links with the gangs, because one time he said, here, I've got some pure top quality coke. And there's a picture that comes on WhatsApp, right? And there's this coke. So like a month later, he sends Rodrigo a message. He said, Rodrigo, do you have like a gram of coke and 10 grams or whatever, and like some marijuana? Can you please? And he delivers it to this guy's 32nd highest Mandarin building, you know, the big Louis the 16th gates and everything. Guy goes and delivers it there. And then he says, I'm at the gate. And it was all WhatsApp. So the court documents contains a criminal investigation, and quite a lot of the guy never learned to speak Portuguese, but he'd use a translator. It's obvious. And some of the conversations, like with the first girlfriend, were in English. There's proof in that first conversation that he was running out of, he started stalling and not paying these investors back. So she was bringing him, the first girlfriend was bringing him investors. And she was like, John, that's what she called him. Where's the money? I need to pay the investor back. So he was definitely up to the same tricks in Brazil as MTI was before that.
Okay, Stephen, we're going to leave it there. That was a fascinating delve into a very interesting and very uniquely South African story with a strange twist. And we don't quite know where this ends and whether, in fact, Steinberg is alive or dead. But from what you're saying, you're pretty convinced he was dead beforehand. Now you're 50-50 on it. So there's more work to be done maybe before we get to the bottom of this. Great, Stephen. Thanks very much for joining us on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast.
Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.